This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. It's been 17 years since the 9/11 attacks that killed nearly 3,000 people on U.S. soil. I know I'm thinking today about my own memories from that day, and I'm sure many of you are as well. 9/11 drastically altered the course of this country, and it also altered the lives of many Muslims in the United States forever, changing political affiliation, career aspirations, family dynamics, and beyond. And today we talk to two people who've experienced some of that change, and they want to share that with us. And they're also experts in American-Islamic relations and observers of what this 17-year period has meant for Muslims across the world and in the United States. Shadi Hamid is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and author of the book Islamic Exceptionalism, How the Struggle Over Islam is Reshaping the World. And Zainab Chowdhury is director of Maryland Outreach for the Council on American-Islamic Relations. Welcome to you both.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being with us. And so questions to both of you, and then we can get specific. How did your relationship change with Islam after 9/11? What was it like being a Muslim American during that time?
So I was actually a freshman in college when 9/11 happened, so already a very impressionable time. And I think that before 9/11, you know, I obviously saw myself, you know, as Muslim, but it wasn't something you were super conscious about because most Americans didn't really know much about Islam. They didn't care about it that much because there still wasn't a major national security component. Then 9/11 happens. And I think for us as American Muslims, it's sort of a tragedy in two ways, of course, as Americans, but also as Muslims who are trying to make sense of how could people possibly do this in our name. And for me, it was a formative political moment. Then anti-Muslim sentiment increases afterwards. You have the Bush administration's Patriot Act. Then you have the Iraq War. So you have a chain of events that happen in this very rapid series. And it forced many of us to become more political. And I became more interested in Middle East politics. There was a sense that the relationship between the U.S. and the Middle East was going in a very dangerous direction. And that's part of what actually pushed me to move into the career that I happen to be in right now. So of looking at the role of Islam in politics, of looking at U.S. foreign policy. And I think for many American Muslims, you see that shift of trying to get more involved in American politics and trying to do whatever we can to serve, I know it's a bit of a cliche, but to serve as a bridge between the U.S. and the broader Muslim world and to do whatever we can to play a more constructive role.
To a large degree, I do agree. I remember, 9/11 is one of those moments in history when, everybody remembers where we were, what we were doing at that time. And I think for many American Muslims, we can define our lives as pre-9/11 and post-9/11. I was actually in pharmacy school. I had just started my fall semester of my freshman year in pharmacy school in Baltimore. And I remember, very visceral fear, like the angst amongst our communities. That day specifically, my father had called me while I was sitting in class. And I had just started wearing the headscarf, the hijab, a few months prior. And he immediately, told me, he said, take off your headscarf. And I was shocked and I was like, why should I do that? And he said, we'll talk about it when you get home. Just take off your hijab. And I remember
And that's a powerful thing for a father to say. I mean, and you had no idea why.
We were just starting to learn that a plane had hit the Twin Towers in New York. We were just getting information of the attack in Pennsylvania. And we had just learned from our vice dean, associate dean, who had come down to our classroom and told us that class was dismissed and school was going to be closed for the day and we could leave. And so we knew something was going on. We knew that it was serious, but we didn't know at that time exactly what the implications of those days and events were going to be. It wasn't until later on when I was at my friend's dorm. She lived across the street from pharmacy school. And I went to her dorm and we were just watching TV. And I remember sitting there on the couch, just with a sinking feeling in my heart, thinking that life is never going to be the same again. And sure enough, in the days following that, we saw a spike in anti-Muslim incidents, anti-Muslim bigotry, hate crimes, bias incidents targeting the Sikh American community specifically. There was a murder of a Sikh gas station owner. And I remember that, you know, the climate of suspicion and scrutiny and fear, especially against American Muslims, was something that can't be really articulated properly in words, but it was something that I knew was going to change the course of my life. And sure enough, even though I did go on to complete pharmacy school, there was always this like sense of wanting to do work that would help to, connect the American Muslim community with broader society. I think pre-9/11, many Muslim communities tended to exist in silos. And the tragic events of that day forced many Muslims to kind of break out of our silos and be more vocal and articulate about our narrative and what Islam is, and do a lot of introspection as well, do a lot of research about what our own religion says so that we can explain it well to others and demystify and, break down a lot of the stereotypes that exist about Islam and Muslims.
I'd love to get both of your thoughts on this, because when we'll talk about this a little bit, the current administration in a little bit, but after 9/11, the Bush administration created a foreign policy that basically targeted the broader Muslim world. And I'm wondering made a target out of the broader Muslim world. And I'm wondering whether that had any effect on, as you were mentioning, American Muslim communities here in the United States.
So one effect was that it pushed American Muslims away from the Republican Party towards the Democratic Party. And I know this might be hard to believe now, but my parents, for example, and a plurality of Muslims in 2000 voted for George W. Bush. And there was a real sense that, even in some communities, that Muslims should rally around George W. Bush for. And part of that had to do with Muslims seeing themselves as a more socially conservative community. But then after 9/11, the Bush administration becomes associated with these very problematic policies, at least from a Muslim the perspective of many Muslims, with, of course, as I mentioned before, the Patriot Act. The Iraq War was very unpopular among American Muslims generally. And Democrats over time start to portray themselves as, more accepting of American Muslims, just like they're more accepting of a number of other minority communities. And that's a really important realignment, I think, and we're seeing the effects of that to this very day.
And I also want to bring up the current administration, obviously. I'm wondering if either of you can sort of speak to the whether or not you think the relationship between 9/11 has impacted, and the Muslim community or the American community writ large, has really influenced where we are today politically, particularly with the election of Donald Trump, particularly given this sort of the brown menace policies, if you will, that have come out of this administration. That's my description for many of the policies that sort of paint communities of color as menacing and threatening.
One thing that we've seen is definitely the normalization of and even the encouragement of bigotry and fear-mongering towards communities of color, including American Muslims, but not just limited to that one community. We saw during the presidential campaign season in 2015 to 2016, for the first time in recent history, where an entire campaign that was based on fear-mongering and inciting bias and hatred towards one faith group specifically was successful in reaching an electorate that helped to elect a president that ran a campaign on demonizing Islam and vilifying Muslims, who openly called for a complete and total shutdown of Muslims entering the United States, who promised to build a wall to protect American interests and to make sure that Americans were safe, who really ran like this entire campaign that was rooted in demonizing communities of color and specifically American Muslims. And it helped to not only normalize, but also encourage bigotry towards Muslims. And I remember having a conversation immediately after the 2016 presidential election, and many Muslims felt betrayed that our country had in effect elected a president who had promised to do everything that was he could possibly do to prohibit Muslims from being a vibrant part of society in the United States. And a large part of that is tied into the Islamophobia and the fear-mongering and the bigotry that we've seen in the aftermath of 9/11. However, one thing that is a little bit different is in the aftermath of 9/11, we saw from President Bush, there was this almost immediate kind of sense of distancing the war on terror from Islam. He visited a mosque. He reached out to the Muslim community. He invited Sheikh Hamza Yusuf, who was a prominent scholar at that time, to sit down with him and have conversation. And he made this very concerted effort to kind of distance Islam and Muslims from the campaign on the or the war on terror, which in theory, on paper, it seemed like it was effective. But in reality, we saw from the spike of hate crimes and bias incidents towards Muslims, one could argue that it might not have been as effective as one would have hoped. But there was that concerted effort to try to distance the terror attacks from the broader Muslim community. And that, in to some degree, did help to control the number of hate crimes and incidents that took place against Muslims. But over the course of the decade following that, with the Patriot Act and with the blanket surveillance of the American Muslim community that incited fear and suspicion and paranoia, unfortunately, that those policies have effectively created this dichotomy where many Muslims have been seen as other, as the other, as second-class citizens, as not worthy of being, seen with equal reverence as other Americans.
This is the 17th anniversary. It's hard to believe there are people who weren't even around when 9/11 happened. And I'm curious what your thoughts are for younger Muslim Americans who are learning about this today and sort of dealing with the ramifications of 9/11 without having even been there.
For younger American Muslims, I think their formative moment's going to be different. It'll be primarily about the Trump administration. And that's negative, as Zainab mentioned, but there's also the positive in the sense that a lot of Muslims are becoming even more politically active. And we just saw two young American Muslim women will be serving in Congress. We saw Abdullah Sayyid running for governor in Michigan. And I think a lot of that has to do with a positive reaction to Trump of Muslims saying, we made some progress since 9/11, but we got to do even more right now.
Shadi Hamid is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and Zainab Chowdhury is director of Maryland Outreach for the Council on American-Islamic Relations. Many thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you.
In theory, ankle monitors are supposed to allow a criminal offender to live life outside of prison walls. But people who have lived with ankle monitors on say the devices come with their own problems.
On the inside of the device, which presses against my ankle and my skin, it kind of looks like a drain. And what it does, it vibrates every 30 minutes. And when it vibrates, it's suctioning air. So it's testing my sweat and the atmosphere around me for any alcohol content.
Valeria Vargas is a teacher in Chicago who wore an ankle monitoring device for 3 months after being charged with driving under the influence. She had to pay more than $100 a week for her device, and we'll hear from her in a minute. Valeria is one of more than 125,000 accused and convicted criminal offenders who have been tracked by monitoring devices every single day in the United States. And that number has more than doubled over the last decade.
I think we don't think about it nearly enough when we have our smartphones that also track where we are. But imagine if that smartphone is linked to a law enforcement agency such as probation or parole or pretrial services, and any wrong move or what they consider to be a wrong move, being in a place where they say you can't be or doing something that you can't do, results in perhaps going right back to jail or prison. That's the issue with what we've created with this sort of rise of ankle bracelets and monitoring that now is just part and parcel of how we do criminal justice in this country.
That's Insha Rahman, a program director with the Vera Institute of Justice, and she's concerned about the growing use of these devices. I asked Insha to take me through this technology and what it means for those who are ordered to use it.
monitoring is used not only to locate where a person is at all times, but also things such as whether they are drinking alcohol. You know, there are bracelets called SCRAM bracelets that literally alert the agency that's monitoring the person if there appears to be any sort of alcohol in their system.
Let's talk a little bit about the rise in this type of technology. I mean, we know technology is influencing policing. Talk specifically about, you know, how we've seen an increase in law enforcement sort of relying on this type of technology.
People often cite the 2.2 million Americans who are in our jails and prisons, but a far bigger number, in fact, twice as big, is the 4.5 million Americans who are under community supervision. And many, hundreds of thousands of those Americans are under what's called community supervision. That is actually essentially what are open-air jails. They are monitored either by GPS technology or sort of traditional ankle bracelets, and their movements are tracked. But one thing I want to touch upon that I think is really important as we talk about ankle bracelets and monitoring is not just simply the fact of its proliferation and how often it is used, but that when it is used, this is technology, and we know this. Technology can fail us and does, and one thing that we have seen more and more with ankle bracelets and monitoring is that sometimes there are false alarms. Somebody is where they're supposed to be, they are at work or at their home, yet the device pings the agency that's monitoring them and suggests that they are somewhere else. That triggers a warning, a violation, and it can cause all sorts of problems for that person, from a check-in with the probation officer or pretrial services officer to perhaps even being put back in jail or prison.
Now, who exactly are using these ankle bracelets? Is it for people who are waiting trial? Is it people who are on parole? Is it people who, when does this come into play for someone?
At each of those points in the criminal justice system, there are tens of thousands, at least, people who have not been convicted of any crime, who are pretrial, meaning they are out in the community pending their case and going back to court, who are on ankle monitoring and ankle bracelets. There are people who are on parole who are on ankle monitoring, ankle bracelets, and people on probation as well. So it really spans the gamut. It's not just used in the criminal justice system, but also in systems like our immigration system. There's been a growing use, especially of private companies who administer and operate these ankle monitors in partnership with the federal government, for people, for immigrants who are fighting their deportation cases or their immigration cases and are, again, out in the community while their case is going on.
We are speaking to someone, a woman who has had to pay about $107 a week for her own electronic monitoring device. That's stunning to me. Is that normal? Is it common for people to have to pay for their own monitoring device?
That doesn't actually surprise me at all, sadly. Yes, it's common and increasingly becoming more common. There are some states and some localities that bear the cost of putting an ankle monitor on somebody, and those costs range from anywhere from $5 to up to $20 a day. But there are many, many states and localities that actually impose that cost on the person being monitored. And that's if they are pretrial or on probation or on parole. And so imagine this is if you can't afford that $5 or $20 a day to pay for your ankle monitor, what's the alternative? You're put back in jail.
Well, I'm sure there are also people who would say, you know what, if you have the alternative could be, like you said, being in jail or being in prison. So this isn't that bad of an approach.
I think the only people who would say that this isn't that bad are people who have never worn an ankle monitor or been monitored. And here's why, is because it is not insignificant to have your movements and what you are doing tracked at any given moment. Importantly, it's also there are other problems with the technology, such as having to plug in to recharge your monitor every couple of hours. Additionally, the sort of false positives, the false alarms, are also no small thing that can cause a huge, huge inconvenience again and again for people on these bracelets. People think, well, at least monitoring and ankle bracelets will keep people who are not in jail or prison sort of on the right side of the law. That actually isn't true. There is very little additional public safety gains from having somebody on electronic monitoring or an ankle bracelet than there is than just straight up doing pretrial services or probation that looks much more traditional, like there's an officer who checks in, there are services provided. I think it's one of the misconceptions that we have about electronic monitoring is that it enhances public safety. And the truth is, what we know is we can get as much public safety by having people be released on pretrial services or on probation or on parole without additional monitoring. It doesn't actually get us anything more, while it does, in fact, have a huge impact on that individual person's lives, as well as on costs as well.
Insha Rahman is a program director with the Vera Institute of Justice. Insha, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And now we turn back to the story of one woman with firsthand experience wearing the device as a punishment for a crime. Valeria Vargas is a poet and an educator based in Chicago who just got her ankle monitor removed over the weekend. She calls the monitor a scram device, referring to the company that manufactures them.
I got a DUI last year, so I successfully mitigated the charges down to reckless driving. But as a condition of the charges being mitigated down, as well as my supervision for 18 months, I had to wear the scram device for 90 days. That was a request of the district attorney.
And was this your first offense?
It was.
Now, we understand that you had to pay for this device. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
So the way that was explained to me was I was given kind of like a quote-unquote discount since I made under $60,000 a year. Over $60,000, you pay the full price, and I don't remember what that was, but based on my income level, the first day I got it on, I was required to pay $450. That was $350 for the setup and $100 for technically the last week that I would have had the device. Depending on how the device transmitted the data, they added more charges, I should say. So you had three options. You had a device in your home, like a little monitor that sent the data over to Scram Systems. So it was either by phone line, by Ethernet cord, or if you didn't have access to either of those things, you had to check in with a field officer daily.
So, Valeria, I'm curious about something. You do admit that you did do the infraction, right? You were driving
Yes.
under the influence, right? So,
Yes.
in lieu of going to jail or having this ankle monitor placed on you, what is there something else, another penalty that you would have preferred?
Absolutely. So another condition of these infractions was that I attend drug and alcohol counseling. And I feel like that has been more helpful than that monitor. If I had access to why, you know, like a therapist or some sort of psychiatrist that would help me identify why I did what I did, not necessarily shame me for doing so or pay out money to a company for doing so, that would have worked a lot better. And I'm more so thinking about, like, I'm very privileged, right? I'm very lucky to be middle class. I'm very lucky to have a decent paying job. I'm educated. You know, all of those things offer me privilege. So the cost of this bracelet wasn't necessarily as harmful as it would be to someone with a family, right? Or someone who's low income. And I'm thinking about them. If you miss a payment, if you don't have access to transmit this data, that's it for you. It's over. Like, you have to go to jail, you have to report to court, and the process starts all over again. So I'm not necessarily thinking about myself when I think about the inequities that come with this bracelet.
Did the device have any effect in helping you, whether that means not drinking, lessening your drinking, or anything having to do with that? Was it effective at all?
I mean, I was sober for 90 days. I completed the program. I didn't drink for that time.
And longer term, do you think the device will have had an effect?
I mean, I drank as soon as I got it off, so no.
We did reach out to Scram Systems, the company that manufactures the ankle bracelet that you were
right.
wearing, and they told us that the monitors are supplied through local providers and correction agencies, and it's those folks who determine how much money someone should pay. Does that matter to you? Who makes the decision in terms of who pays what?
It does, yes. It's always, for me, an equity issue. And more importantly, where is that money going? Who is it going to? what programs is it funding, whose pockets is it entering, all that is essential information.
Valeria Vargas is a poet and educator in Chicago. Valeria, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
And we turn now to a story out of North Carolina. We're less than 2 months from the midterm elections, and days ago, county officials in North Carolina were caught off guard by a huge request. In August, the federal prosecutor in North Carolina's Eastern District issued subpoenas for millions of voter records, and that included registrations, ballots, and more, all on behalf of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. And that sent county officials scrambling to figure out how to comply.
Staff are scrambling to fill positions for early voting polling stations. This comes out of the blue. This is a demand for millions of documents in 3 weeks. It's absurd.
That's Greg Flynn, and he's the chairman of the Wake County Board of Elections, speaking to WRAL.
We haven't even printed ballots yet, so we have to deal with that.
Since then, the U.S. Attorney Robert Higdon, a Trump appointee, has scaled down his demands, giving the boards of election until January to comply. But the fight isn't over. On Friday, North Carolina's State Board of Elections voted unanimously to do whatever necessary to keep from providing those voter records to federal prosecutors and ICE.
This board will not stand idly by and consent to an agency attempting to obtain records and documents that violate the principles of overreach by the federal government.
To help us understand all this, I spoke with Melissa Boughton. She covers courts and law for NC Policy Watch. And I started by asking her what kinds of records are the U.S. Attorney and ICE looking for and why.
They initially asked for everything from our State Board of Elections and 44 county boards of elections in the eastern part of North Carolina for the past 8 years. And that includes all voter registration forms, early voting, provisional voting forms. These are documents that have driver's license numbers, social security numbers, and the addresses of every North Carolina voter over the past 8 years, all of their voting records, and they had even initially asked for the cast ballots of those voters. They have since kind of walked back their request and asked that those documents be redacted after significant media coverage pointed out that the privacy of about 2.2 million voters in North Carolina would have been compromised had those documents been turned over.
And Melissa, we did reach out to U.S. Attorney Higdon's office, and they declined to comment on the investigation. What can you tell us about where this could actually be headed?
This is most likely connected with an investigation in which they recently indicted 19 foreign nationals and charged them with illegal voting. Those folks range in age from 26 to 71, and they're from all over the U.S. But they were indicted by a grand jury in Wilmington, North Carolina. And this is assuming the same grand jury that these subpoenas are asking for our election officials to appear before. So similarly to you, we have not gotten a response from the U.S. Attorney's Office. But that is the question on everyone's mind, is why this request? It's so broad. And there isn't any reason that has been given thus far. And so it's got a lot of people questioning the motive.
That was Melissa Boughton, reporter with NC Policy Watch. I also spoke with North Carolina Representative David Price, a Democrat whose district includes Raleigh and Chapel Hill. He and other lawmakers are demanding answers about these subpoenas from the Department of Homeland Security and the Justice Department. And last week, he put out a statement calling this, quote, alarming and unprecedented.
Partly it's just the scale of this. Millions and millions of records, a lot of them threatening to compromise the privacy of voters. But just an overwhelming burden on these election boards for no clear rationale. They've now said they can wait till February, but that doesn't really help very much. What we're left to conclude, I think, is that this is all about President Trump's initial claim after the election, this bizarre claim, false claim, that millions of undocumented immigrants voted illegally in 2016. So then this Pence-Kobach Commission was created to investigate voter fraud. The commission was disbanded, as we know, but President Trump deputized the Homeland Security Department to continue the work. So the fact that ICE is a party to this, ICE along with the Justice Department, finding apparently this willing U.S. attorney in eastern North Carolina to carry the water, this gives you a pretty good tip-off as to what this is about.
And Congressman, what are you hearing from your constituents about this? Are they concerned? Are they aware?
It just came out of the blue. So that's, I think, mainly just shock and bafflement. This is just an overwhelming request. And by the way, the State Elections Board, which isn't known for making bipartisan decisions, in this case, Republicans, Democrats, everybody on that elections board, ask our attorney general here in the state to investigate this claim, to file whatever kind of legal actions were required to deal with this, because it's just out of the blue, although, as I said, it figures, and when you think about it, it follows the narrative that the president has perpetrated ever since he lost the popular vote in the election.
Congressman David Price represents North Carolina's 4th District. Central America is experiencing a terrible drought. On Friday, UN officials warned that nearly 3 million people in the region could face a food shortage after poor rainfall devastated crops this summer. In Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Nicaragua, governments have declared a state of emergency or requested humanitarian help. Joining me now to discuss the situation is Dr. Rebecca Keller, a senior analyst with the geopolitical intelligence firm Stratfor. Dr. Keller, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So there are agencies monitoring the situation in Central America that have said that it could be made worse by El Niño. Remind us what El Niño is and how it could drive this drought.
So El Niño is a weather pattern driven by the temperatures of the Pacific Ocean in certain locations. And basically what happens is when it becomes an El Niño year, it's droughts and either rain or drought is more likely in different locations around the world. And during El Niño years, Central America tends to be more vulnerable to drought.
So who is going to be impacted by the drought in this region?
Right. So this region is just recovering from a pretty long, severe, extended drought that stretched between 2014 and early 2017. And you're looking at, it's sort of sometimes referred to as the dry corridor. It's parts of El Salvador, Guatemala, Nicaragua, and Honduras. And it's small farmers that don't have a lot of inputs, you know, fertilizer or irrigation, and they really rely on weather patterns to make sure their crops grow and feed. So it's corn or maize and bean farmers in those areas.
And does this have the potential to, I mean, are the local governments helping the farmers in these countries to mitigate some of the damage that this could cause?
Yeah, so we're going to likely see some international aid come in to help these farmers. Both El Salvador and Honduras have already declared either red alerts or states of emergency with respect to the dry weather that they've been having in June and July and the potential of an El Niño coming in the fall or the winter. We will likely see governments and likely international aid step in.
And would that include the United States?
Possibly, yes. It's kind of a difficult geopolitical situation right now that we're looking at. There's a number of overlying factors between the U.S. and Central America at the moment. There's the underlying security situation that's been there for a while. It's a drug corridor, so there's that security situation. But you've got a couple of other sort of moving factors going through right now. There's a potential leadership crisis in Nicaragua, which the U.S. has been threatening sanctions, so that could complicate matters in Nicaragua. And then Central America has sort of been a center for a diplomatic dispute between the U.S. and China over recognition of Taiwan. And we've seen countries switch sides recently, specifically El Salvador in August when they backed off their diplomatic, they removed their diplomatic ties to Taiwan. So that could influence the U.S.'s behavior in the region moving forward, but I don't know that it will stretch as far as food aid, as removing food aid.
Well, and we also know there's been significant migration from Central America because of the violence in many of the countries there. Is there evidence that this drought could even be a bigger driver of migration out and potentially north?
Absolutely. So the studies from the 2014 to 2016 severe drought show that there was an increase in migration during that period. So should we see this drought increase in severity and length and time, we most certainly could see some forced migration. And then migration from Central America does tend to go north. So that would be into Mexico and into the U.S.
Which is already presenting, I mean, there's already tensions with the United States and Central American migrants. This administration has been particularly on top of that, making sure to limit that type of migration. Could we see even more tension erupt if that happens?
Yeah, but it's definitely a possibility. And that the China-U.S. dispute over Taiwan would also play into that. The U.S. Had a partnership with several of these Central American countries called the Alliance for Prosperity, and that was an effort to slow illegal migration, and it was using social development and security aid to do that. The U.S. canceled a meeting that was supposed to be held this week as part of sort of a show of force against potentially, you know, so Guatemala, Honduras, and Nicaragua still remain in the Taiwanese camp. And so the U.S. has the potential to show levers to counter Chinese, growing Chinese influence in the region. So not only do we have the surface level, the, you know, in-your-face immigration policies from the current White House administration, you have this underlying U.S.-Chinese push and pull going on as well, and Central America is falling into that as well.
What are some of your biggest concerns about this drought going forward?
Well, the first concern is obviously the humanitarian impact. It's a very poor region. Most of the farmers are either subsistence farmers or they sell on very small markets. Many of them rent the land, and those that do own the land may be forced to sell it. So there's the humanitarian cost moving forward. And then there's also the potential for instability. These countries already they're in the drug trade corridor. There is a, you know, high level of violence that could only be exacerbated by this drought.
Dr. Rebecca Keller is a senior analyst for the geopolitical intelligence firm Stratfor. Thanks so much, doctor.
Thank you.
Back in the Mesozoic era, between 245 and 65 million years ago, dinosaurs roamed the Earth. And when they died, if the conditions were just right, their skeletons slowly turned from bone to stone, leaving behind a precious fossil. But you knew all that from your middle school science class, right? What you might not know is that there's a big international market for fossils, and some of it is illegal. That's the world described in a new book called The Dinosaur Artist: Obsession, Betrayal, and the Quest for Earth's Ultimate Trophy. Author Paige Williams, who's also a staff writer for The New Yorker, spent more than a decade investigating the past, present, and future of the trade. And at the heart of her book is the tension between the people who hunt and sell fossils commercially and the academic paleontologists.
There used to be no tension between them. The way we even got into natural history as human beings was that we walked around and we looked at interesting things and we wondered what they were and what made them and what we might learn about the history of the Earth from them. But then when paleontology developed as a science, there arose this tension between people who hunt fossils for fun and as hobby and the scientists who need those objects in order to do their science. These are the objects that are fundamental to their science. So there's been tension surrounding who has a right to look for objects of natural history, and fossils in particular, and who has the right not just to hunt them, but also to collect them, to work with them, to display them, to own them. And some scientists see the value in the commercial side, as long as it's not something rare, like a vertebrate fossil that's going to not be found anywhere else.
Is there a market? Are people, like, buying fossils?
They
because,
do.
Like, for commercial purposes, for gifts and things like that.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. And because they enjoy collecting. Collectors are obsessives, and they're fascinating in that way because they will, as Martin Arell says in the book, he's met fossil collectors who don't just take 10 or don't just collect, you know, 20. Their whole house is layered with them, even in the dishwasher. He found some fossils in one person's house. So collector obsession drives the market. Science classrooms drive the market. Hobbyists who like to go out hiking and just looking for keepsakes of the world around them collect them. And then most of the market happens either these days online or at the big trade shows that happen in Tucson and Denver and Munich and Tokyo. And so people just flood those cities during those market times. And it's like walking around a department store, but for natural history. And there's tension even surrounding that. Like, should that be happening? Should scientific objects be commercialized to the point that anybody can have them?
How does this play out in the United States? I mean, we mentioned this sort of the international market for fossils, but do we have rules in this country? Are there fossil limitations for how many fossils you can actually have, or is it just an open market?
It depends on where you are. It's a really good question. The federal lands, you can't collect fossils, except for some sort of surface-level fossils that don't require you to disturb the earth or to dig. Vertebrates, certainly not, like dinosaurs on federal land. No, that's illegal. So the national parks have some dinosaurs, for example. BLM land, the Bureau of Land Management property, which is vast, especially in the American West, has loads of fossils. And it's illegal to go and take those objects off that property. But in the United States, and this is the only country that's like this, if you find a fossil of any sort, no matter whether it's new to science or one of thousands, if it's on your property or on property where you have permission to collect or dig or hunt, you can keep it, you can destroy it, you can sell it, you can do anything you want to with it. So property rights in this country have taken precedence over, the scientists would say, taken precedence over a more robust protection system for fossils.
So we've talked about the United States, but in your book, you talk a lot about Mongolia. Tell us why this is such an important player in this fossil trade.
It's an important player in paleontology because the Gobi Desert is such a wonderland of fossils. It has been called the Garden of Eden of fossils because so many types of fossils have been found there, and in such abundance and in such good shape, because there's nothing in the Gobi and nothing's been built on top of them. So the bones there are very beautiful and pristine, and the coloring is gorgeous. And so they're extraordinary to work with in that way. In terms of the trade, they're illicit materials. So when they started turning up, when Gobi dinosaurs in particular started turning up at trade shows and at market, some commercial hunters thought, oh, they must have changed the law. So now we can all go in and, or if you're a risk taker, we can go in and look for our own. Others thought, nope, this is not. It's not okay. It's still illegal, and everyone must beware. But no one was really policing this area. So when the Gobi dinosaurs started showing up, they rivaled American dinosaurs in some ways.
So we sort of touched on this, but in your book, you also write about the black market for the fossil trade, and you focus on one case in particular. And this is the case of a 28-foot-long skeleton of a T-Rex cousin found in Mongolia that went to auction in 2012. So you've already told us that it's illegal to sell any fossils found in the country. So how big is the black market?
It's hard to know whether a black market and how it expands. The market existed. The black market existed before this case. This certainly did have an effect on how people see the black market. And since this case happened, I've been told by a lot of commercial dealers that they self-police in a way that they weren't policing the trade before.
For fear of
going to prison, for fear of being almost as bad, labeled as a dealer who can't be trusted or whom no one wants to work with. So in terms of how big the black market in Gobi Desert dinosaurs or any dinosaurs is, it's hard to put a number on that. And whether it's expanded, I don't know.
Paige, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Paige Williams is the author of The Dinosaur Artist, and it's out today. And that's our show for today. Of course, you can give us a call about anything you heard on the show at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can also join the conversation on the Takeaways Facebook page, or you can connect with me on Twitter. I'm at Tanzina Vega. Thanks so much for listening. This is The Takeaway.